from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In the 12 years since armies of lawyers argued over hanging chads in Florida, election-related lawsuits have more than doubled. Law professor and election law expert Richard Hassan says we should expect even more bitter partisan disputes over election law in coming years. We'll discuss voter ID laws, claims of voter fraud, and voter suppression, plus Hassan's new book, The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. On Forum, next. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. New state voter ID laws have included, with Indiana's the first back in 2006, photo identification upheld by the Supreme Court and other requirements such as proof of citizenship. Since the 2000 presidential election, which saw George W. Bush elected over, or at least winning over Al Gore, politically polarizing arguments have gone back and forth with, for the most part, Republicans charging Democrats with voter fraud and Democrats charging Republicans with voter suppression. Joining us for this forum hour to discuss voting rules and ongoing election battles led by armies of lawyers is UC Irvine political science and law school professor Richard Hassan. Rick Hassan, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And Rick Hassan is the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the New Election Meltdown. First, we also want to check in with Kim Alexander, founder and head of the California Voter Foundation, who is with us from Sacramento. And Kim Alexander, good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
I guess I'd like to begin with you. We're going to talk mostly hour with Rick Hassan, but just to get a sense of what's going on now in California, there's no voter ID law here, but there is a good deal more accessibility because of online registration. And yet at the same time, we're hearing complaints from the disabled about accessibility. And we're also hearing about online being not that secure.
Well, the online system in California, I feel confident, is secure. Secretary of State and her staff have worked very hard to set that up. We require 3 forms of ID when people check in to do an online transaction, which is more than other states are requiring. But we do have a number of ways for people to get registered to vote, and the deadline's October 22nd, which is also a much later deadline than a lot of other states.
You're concerned, perhaps, with the number that are going to be registering this year?
I think it's going to be greater. I think what we're going to see, actually, is a lot of people being able to more easily update their registration record through the online system. If you do it, you know, on a paper form, you have to get the form. You've got to fill out the entire form, get it mailed. It can take a week or so. Some people just have a hard time getting their hands on them. But the online form, which you can get at registertovote.ca.gov, is really accessible and easy to work with. I think it's going to create more accurate records and maybe reduce the amount of provisional voting that we see at polling places, too.
We have no photo ID in California, no photo ID law, but if accessibility is, well, not accessibility so much as security is a concern, maybe we need photo ID in California.
That's an interesting debate, and it's going on in California, although we have, unlike a lot of other states, we have a democratically controlled legislature, a democratic governor, and a democratic secretary of state, so there's not a lot of support to be found among that group of leaders for photo ID law. There's other forms of ID, too, that you can show. And we actually do have a modest voter ID law that comes from the Help America Vote Act, which requires first-time voters to show some form of ID when they register to vote. In some states, that's a photo ID, and HAVA left it up to the states to define what that ID would be. In some states, made that a photo ID. We accept a debit card, credit card, things that you might be already carrying in your wallet. So even that ID requirement is a much more lenient than other states.
There is a phenomenon that Rick Hassan in his book calls the fraudulent fraud squad, and I'm wondering just to what extent we might have to worry about fraud in California, or it ought to be a concern. I know there's monitoring going on in King and Yuba counties and Monterey as well.
That's right, and we do have a history of vote suppression in California among minority voters, and that's why we have monitoring under the Federal Voting Rights Act in some of our counties. There's always that risk, but the truth is that we don't have a lot of instances of it in California. What I wish is that there was more advertising about the fact that when voters sign that poll book in the polling place, they're signing under penalty of perjury. We don't really let that be known. I think that might help give voters more peace of mind about this perception that there could be fraud.
And can you say something before we say goodbye about same-day registration?
There was a bill that was just signed by the governor. It won't be implemented immediately that would allow people to go to their county election office and register and vote on election day. But I want to say one more thing about this, which is we already have a form of same-day voter registration in California. It's just not advertised. If you move after the registration deadline or even before it and you didn't re-register but you're still in the same county, you can go to what will be your new polling place and register to vote there and get a provisional ballot that will get counted. So we're already letting voters do it in a way.
Kim Alexander with us from Sacramento is president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. They're a nonpartisan, nonprofit working group to improve the voting process and to better serve voters. And Kim, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
As I said earlier, Rick Hassin is also with us. He's professor of law and political science, UC Irvine School of Law, author of The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And Rick Hassin, it would appear the Democrats have been at least traditionally and historically hurt more, a great deal more. But voter fraud and voter suppression have been charged by both sides. That is, voter fraud mainly by Republicans, voter suppression mainly by Democrats. And both are greatly exaggerated, really, aren't they?
Well, that is one of the central claims that I make in my book, that since 2000, we've seen this escalating partisan war where each party charges the other with some kind of foul play or malfeasance. If you look at the history of what's happened since 2000, we've seen a consistent pattern of Republican legislatures and Republican state election officials, because we do elect many of our state chief election officers through partisan elections, adopting measures that tend to help Republicans and hurt Democrats. And then on the other side, you see Democratic legislatures and Democratic chief election officers adopting measures that make it easier for people to vote, such as what just happened in California, which Republicans claim opens the door for fraud. And we can talk about the different kinds of fraud and how these laws might prevent it. But I do think that there is a fair amount of exaggeration on the Democratic side and a huge amount of exaggeration on the Republican side when it comes to the specific question of the type of fraud that a voter ID law would prevent, which is in-person impersonation voter fraud.
Well, that happens very rarely, according to your book, and there are a few cases of election fraud in general. More, I suppose, tampering or difficulty from election officials, as you point out, trying to change results, or from absentee balloting being used, which voter ID really can't protect against.
Yeah, well, there was a great story yesterday in the Washington Post about the kinds of problems that occur in elections. And typically, we see one of two things. Either we see election officials who are manipulating the process. And so down here in Southern California, the city of Cudahy, small city outside of the city of Los Angeles within the county, you had local officials who were steaming open the absentee ballots as they came in. If they were votes for incumbents, they would reseal them and count those ballots later. And if they were votes for challengers, they throw them away. So that's one way to steal the election on a wholesale level. It doesn't happen a lot. I don't want to exaggerate it all, but it does happen a fair amount that you see election officials interfering with ballots. The other kind of fraud that we see at least every year somewhere in the country, and somewhat more frequently than that, is absentee ballot fraud. And this usually involves people buying and selling absentee ballots. You know, if you want to steal an election, if you use absentee ballots, you can verify how somebody voted, collect the ballot, and do it that way. And so we do see prosecutions like that every once in a while. But if you wanted to steal an election through impersonation fraud, you know, the kind of fraud that a voter ID law would prevent, I go to the polls, I claim that I'm you, it would be a very tough thing to do. Either you'd have to have a lot of people who would know who's not showing up at the polling place on election day. You'd have to hope that the poll workers don't know these people and say, you're not my neighbor who's you're signing in for. Or you'd have to register a whole bunch of fake people months in advance and then go up and show that you are this person. I looked for a case in the last generation, single case. Could I find a single case where an election result anywhere in the country could have been manipulated through this kind of impersonation fraud? And I couldn't find a single case of that, while we find cases of absentee ballot fraud every year.
It seems to be, at this point, almost demonstrably, a movement away from a lot of the attempt to scrutinize more through photo ID. I mean, what happened in Pennsylvania, for example, I'd like you to talk about that, or the Texas ID law that was overturned. Is this where we're headed, do you think?
Okay, so if you look at the modern trend, what happened was that first Indiana and Georgia adopted these new tough photo ID laws in the mid-2000s. Indiana's law was, as you mentioned, upheld against what's called a facial challenge by the U.S. Supreme Court. The court said, generally speaking, these kinds of laws don't violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. But if there are particular voters who are burdened by the law, they can come and bring a separate challenge that the law is unconstitutional as to them. We haven't seen a lot of those challenges, which is one indication to me that there aren't really a lot of people that are disenfranchised by these laws, and we can come back and talk about that. Georgia's law was also upheld by the Department of Justice. Georgia, with a history of racial discrimination voting, has to get approval for its laws. The Bush Justice Department approved that law. And now we fast forward to what's happened since then, which is that a number of Republican-led states have adopted these laws. Texas, like Georgia, was subject to this preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, but now it was the Obama Justice Department that took over from the Bush Justice Department. Obama Justice Department objected to Texas ID law, and a three-judge court just agreed that the law would place a burden on minority voters. That case is going to the U.S. Supreme Court after the election. I think it's there's a reasonably good chance that by the time the court might hear that case, the Supreme Court may already have struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as unconstitutional. So that's on that side. So this Texas law, which is much stricter than even the Indiana or Georgia law, may end up going into effect. In Pennsylvania, the only thing at issue yesterday when the state judge issued his ruling was whether the ID law was going to be implemented in time for this election. And it looked like there were thousands of voters in Pennsylvania who are eligible to vote, and the state could not get IDs that would be acceptable to them in time. And so the judge said, you can't use this on election day. He actually said that poll workers could ask for ID, but if a voter didn't have it, the voter would still be allowed to vote. But there's going to now be, after the election, a trial. It seems pretty clear that the judge is going to uphold the photo ID law in future elections, and that the state Supreme Court looks like may unanimously uphold against a state constitutional challenge Pennsylvania's ID law. So while there have been some temporary victories for opponents of voter ID laws, I think the long-term trend is that these laws are going to be implemented and they're going to be upheld in most places where they are implemented.
But all voter ID legislation was introduced, with the exception of Rhode Island, by Republicans, and over a dozen states with election laws have been approved by GOP legislatures. It seems that so much of the effort is being mounted from the GOP, and I'm wondering if there's any effect here in what happened recently in Florida. There was an anti-voter fraud crusade, which is, in many instances, it's been pointed out by a number of commentators, undermined the Republican crusade.
Well, what happened in Florida was that there's an organization or an individual named Nathan Sproul, who had a set of organizations that were registering voters. And it looks like some of the registration material that had been turned in to election officials was fraudulent. Now, we don't know what type of fraud this is quite yet. There are two different kinds of fraud related to voter registration, one I think much more nefarious than the other. One thing that could happen is...
Well, forgive me, Rick, but wasn't a consulting firm contracted by the Republican Party in Florida to register GOP voters? I mean, that's the investigation.
Yes, absolutely. Right. There's no question about that. But the question is the nature of the fraudulent activity. So one thing that we're hearing is that names of dead voters or fictitious names were turned in on some cards. This is the same thing that happened with the group Acorn, which is now out of business. You may remember Republicans made a lot of political hay about these dead voters or Mary Poppins voters who were turning these forms that were turned in with these names. The reason this type of fraud tends to happen is because organizations like Acorn or Sproul's organization will hire workers to collect forms. And if these workers don't turn in enough forms, even if there's not an official quota, they're going to lose their jobs. And so to keep their jobs, they turn in these forms. This is a troubling and annoying thing to election officials because they have to go through and verify and throw out these Mickey Mouse ballots. Mickey Mouse registration cards. But it turns out that this type of fraud does not lead to actual election fraud. When these fraudulent registration forms are turned in, you don't see voters turning up claiming, I'm Tony Romo, I'm Mary Poppins. Doesn't happen. But the other kind of fraud that's been alleged, and I want to stress that so far as I can tell, nothing's been proven yet, is that someone in Sproul's group may have been changing the addresses on election forms to addresses out of the county for Democratic voters. If that's actually true, that would have the effect of disenfranchising these voters. These voters would then have to cast a provisional ballot, which would not count because they'd be casting that ballot for would not be matching their address in their county. There were also allegations that this Sproul group back in 2004, when they registered voters in Nevada, they would take the Democratic registration forms and throw them away. That never led to criminal charges. There's a lot we don't know, and there's a big difference between this voter registration fraud where you have these extra cards being turned in and these other things that are being alleged and are still being investigated.
We're talking with Rick Hasson. His new book is The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. He's professor of law and political science at UC Irvine School of Law. And as long as we're talking about Florida, we should also mention that a lot of this crusade on the GOP side is being led by Tea Party Governor Rick Scott, but the Florida officials are also saying that they're looking into questionable registration forms turned in by Latino advocacy group, by La Raza specifically, which has denied any wrongdoing. Your book really gets into Florida in a big way because it was really the election in 2000 and that's really moved things to where they are now. At least that's your thesis. And how has the election law been used as a tactic? How things change?
Well, one thing that's changed since 2000 is that election law has become part of a political strategy. That is, in close elections, the parties are looking to use the courts as a way to try and gain advantage. And so before 2000, there were an average of just under 100 cases nationally a year raising election law issues. That number more than doubled to an average of about 240 each year in the period after 2000. So we see more litigation both before elections and after elections. We've seen close contested contests in almost every election season with disputes ranging from fights over absentee ballots and a recount in the Coleman-Franken U.S. Senate race, which you may remember
in Minnesota,
from a few years ago. There was the 2004 governor's race in Washington State, where first the Republican was declared the winner. There was a recount. The Republican was declared the winner again. And then after going to court, and the Democrat was declared the winner. And there were indications of a number of ballots cast by felons in that election, which caused Republicans to claim that there was fraud in the election. Turns out that those felons, these are people who were out of prison, still on parole, many of them, they received registration materials in the mail from election officials and thought they were then eligible to vote, and they registered to vote. That election result was not those ballots from felons were not thrown out because there was no way to know who those felons had voted for, even though the ballots were not legally cast. So we've had just a series of post-Florida fights, and what I worry about is that one of these fights is going to involve the presidential election, and then I think things would be much worse than what we saw in Florida.
Well, we have armies of lawyers poised on this presidential election on both sides, ready to battle it out or do what needs to be done, obviously. I'd like to go back, though, with you, Rick, to the whole question of voter suppression and whether or not, you seem to think this is overblown, but there are many who are worried about it. Perhaps you can clarify a little why it's so overblown or to what extent it's overblown.
Well, in terms of the numbers of people who are affected by these laws, many people are affected by these laws, but it doesn't necessarily mean that their votes are going to be suppressed or they're going to be disenfranchised. Let me give you an important example. The Brennan Center, which does excellent work out of New York, issued a report a few months ago where they said that up to 5 million voters could be affected by recent voting changes. And that figure included about 2 million people who in Florida or Ohio voted on the last weekend before Election Day. It's a big day, especially for African-American churches to run their so-called Souls to the Polls program, get people to go straight from services on buses and go vote. That day in Florida is now gone. There won't be this weekend voting in Florida. And in Ohio, there's a lawsuit now over whether those 3 days will be gone. Right now, a judge has ordered that they be reinstated, but that ruling is pretty likely to be reversed by the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit pretty soon. Of those couple of million voters, most of those voters will simply choose to vote on a different day or vote by absentee ballot. So one of the things that the Ohio election officials point to is the fact that they have now sent, for the first time, absentee ballot applications to every Ohio voter. And so I think it's going to be far fewer than the millions of people that are sometimes claimed on the left that are going to be disenfranchised by a law like a cutback in early voting. In fact, voters will shift from voting in those days to other days. And I think if you probe a lot of these claims, it turns out that, yes, some of these laws may have made it less convenient to be able to vote. But in terms of actually putting very large barriers or insurmountable barriers in front of voters, that seems to not be the case. And if you look at voter ID, one of the things that I find quite striking is that in a lot of these cases, it is very hard for, and I'm going to put Pennsylvania aside because it's this new law and it's taking a long time for them to roll it out. But you look at most of these cases, it's very hard for these institutional plaintiffs groups, the ACLU, the Advancement Project, and others, to find actual voters who, first, lack an acceptable ID, second, can't, with the reasonable effort, get the ID, and third, want to vote.
You mentioned the Brennan Center before, Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Don't they estimate some figures I saw said 11% of voters, voting age citizens, I should say, lack necessary photo ID, and many of them in rural areas have trouble even accessing ID offices.
Yeah, these numbers are quite contested. And it turns out that in a lot of these voters either have the ID or have something that they can easily get the ID. Now, in Texas, there was testimony of some rural voters who would have to travel 200, 250 miles to get a round trip to be able to get one of these acceptable IDs. Texas's law was probably the most stringent in the nation. Texas also wouldn't accept student ID cards, but would accept a concealed weapons permit. Certainly seemed like the intent was to suppress some Democratic turnout. But if you look at the actual numbers of people who, you try and find people who don't have the ID and can't get it, we're talking about a relatively small number of people, certainly not the 11% in the Pennsylvania case. The plaintiffs claimed that up to 9% of Pennsylvania voters lacked the ID. And the state said it was closer to 1%. And the judge looked at the evidence, heard evidence from both sides, and said he believes it's close to that 1% figure.
Rick, excuse me, we are coming up on a hard break, and I want to give out the phone number and invite listeners to join us. We're talking with Rick Hassan about voter ID laws, claims of voter fraud, and voter suppression. His new book is The Voting Wars, and you are welcome to join us. With any questions or comments you might have, our toll-free number available is 866-733-6786. Again, call us from anywhere. We're on Internet and Sirius Satellite, and you can join us, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. You can also go to our Facebook page or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment and communicate that way. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We spoke earlier in this hour with Kim Alexander, the president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. We're looking at voter ID laws, claims of voter fraud, and voter suppression. Rick Hassan is with us for the hour. He's professor of law and political science at UC Irvine's School of Law and the author of The Voting Wars, From Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown, and really traces in his book the partisan political wars that went on since Bush v. Gore, and also points out that a lot of the problems have to do with foxes guarding the henhouse, that is, partisan control of, or at least to some extent, overseeing of the places where you are voting. We're talking not only about California, but the nation on the eve of the first debate, which will be this evening, later on, and in fact, we'll be doing some analysis of that debate tomorrow with George Lakoff, Joe Tooman, and Professor Bill Whalen. So we'll have a Republican and a Democrat, and we'll have Joe Tooman tomorrow. Now we've got Rick Hassin to answer any questions that you might have, and also to get your involvement in this. I just want to say, Rick, I found particularly fascinating your calls for reform in this book, for really nothing less than a new Voting Rights Act, which would, just to sort of highlight what you talk about, one form of ballot, one voting type of machine, maybe even an election board or an election czar, but elections that would be, well, open to voters who would have an ID card that would be given to them when they're 18 years old automatically. So there's no expense, because sometimes the concern is with the financial strains of actually getting IDs and all of that sort of thing. Chances of that kind of voting reform at this point, particularly with partisan interests and with the kind of pressure groups from different parties, seem pretty remote.
Yeah, I do think they are remote. What I propose is that we have a national nonpartisan election administration, the way it's done in most mature democracies. The idea that we have partisan election officials running our elections, I think, is very troubling. You mentioned the partisanship. I want to focus on one other thing, which is the fact that it's not just partisans running the elections, but it's local election officials who often don't know what they're doing or lack the resources. Right? We don't have a single election on election day. We have something like 10,000 or more elections taking place on the local level. And in some places, when election officials make mistakes, it actually disenfranchises voters. If I could take a minute and tell you about a case that's—
You're going to tell us about Waukesha, Wisconsin? Because I thought that was an incredible case.
Well, the Waukesha, Wisconsin story is interesting. I'll tell that one quickly. And then I want to turn to what's happening in Ohio right now, because this could actually affect the outcome of this upcoming election. In Waukesha, the race for the state Supreme Court justice, the controlling justice on a very partisan state Supreme Court, came down to a very close race with the Democrat 200 votes ahead. But then the next morning, the Waukesha County election clerk, who was herself a Republican, used to work for the Republican legislature, announced that she had been storing the votes on her laptop, and she forgot to include an entire city of 15,000 people in her vote totals. When you included those that went from 200 votes with the Democrat on top to 7,000 for the Republican. And then the Democrat, who's supposed to be looking over her shoulder to make sure that she's doing everything right, later issues a statement through the Democratic Party that says something like, "I'm 80 years old. I don't know anything about computers. The numbers Kathy cited seem to add up, but I'm not sure. I'm still very, very confused." And so, you know, this is who we have running our elections, and it is a problem of not just partisanship, but localism. So here's the case in Ohio. Right now, if you cast a provisional ballot in Ohio, you're given a provisional ballot because there's some problem with your ballot. And the reason you cast that provisional ballot is because you have you were sent to the wrong place to vote, which could even be the wrong table in a gymnasium, the wrong precinct. If you were sent to the wrong precinct, your vote will not count under Ohio law. And we know that many of the people who are sent to the wrong precinct, who are given the wrong ballot, are given the wrong ballot because of poll worker error. And so I give the story in my book of someone who's disenfranchised because a poll worker believed that the number 798 in an address was an odd number because it had two odds in it, 7 and 9, and only one even, 8. And so that turned out to be an odd number. Now, all of those voters, and there were something like 14,000 of them in 2008, according to the Ohio Supreme Court, all of those voters can be disenfranchised. Those wrong precinct ballots don't have to be counted. A federal district court recently ruled that under the U.S. Constitution, those ballots must be counted. And now this case is on appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. This is a case that could make it to the Supreme Court. If Ohio turns out to be close, this could be extremely important for election results.
Again, we're talking with Rick Hassin, who makes a brief, if I can put it that way. He's a professor of law, for having American citizens the necessity for us to believe in election integrity, crucial to existing democracies. Let me go to your calls. And we begin with Catherine from Dublin. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for this program. Yes, I was actually a volunteer attorney on a congressional race in 2010, a David Harmer, Jerry McNerney race in what used to be CD 11. It was a very close race. Harmer lost by about 4 votes per precinct. And I'm calling in because I find this topic very interesting, and I want to disagree first with Professor Hassan that voter impersonation at the polls in California is very difficult to do and somewhat easy to catch. It's actually just the opposite. Our system invites it and makes it easy to do, and here's how easy it is to do. An unscrupulous person can walk up to the polls on election day, look at the roster that is posted outside, and see who's shown up and who hasn't shown up. This is a roster that's updated by poll workers throughout the day. Pick somebody to be, walk in and be that person, cast the vote, and put the ballot in the box. And once it's in the box, it's going to get counted. There's nothing to take it out. The real person who comes later in the day, the most they can do is vote provisionally, which goes through a whole other process at the registrar's office. So our system invites it by putting that roster up there. These are rosters that campaigns and unions and interested groups and elections can buy in advance and find out who's at which location and what their voter frequency is. And it's very easy to do and virtually impossible to catch. I've voted at my polling place for the last 10 years, and I've never seen a poll worker there I've known. So you can't rely on poll workers to have personal knowledge of who somebody is.
And let me get Professor Hassan to respond to your comment, and thank you for that, Catherine.
Yeah, so the question is, how often does this happen? That there is the potential for this impersonation, certainly, just like there is the potential that I could walk into a 7-Eleven and rob the 7-Eleven. I don't do that, and most people don't do that. Why would somebody be committing a felony? Why would someone go in and do this? Would there be some kind of concerted effort to steal an election? So how do we know it doesn't happen? You say, well, it's people are trying to hide it, so of course it's difficult to detect. Well, there was a great study that was recently done by a group called News 21, which is a group of graduate students in journalism. I believe they're funded by the Carnegie Foundation. And they contacted every prosecutor's office across the country. And they asked for all of the election-related prosecutions since 2000. And they compiled all of them. And what did we see? We saw hundreds of cases. I think it was something like 434 cases of allegations of absentee ballot fraud. We saw a number of cases of election official fraud, like the fraud in Cudahy that I talked about. In terms of impersonation fraud, there were 10 allegations nationally, not 10 elections, 10 allegations of these kinds of votes. And some of those did not even lead to prosecution. The kind of stories we see when there is this very rare impersonation fraud, I'll give you an example of a case in Texas right now. This is going to trial. The dad is out of town on a business trip. Mom takes Junior, who's got the same name as dad, to vote. He's a 16-year-old, to vote in dad's place. Then dad comes in and tries to vote, and they see that he's already voted, and then an investigation ensues. So we just don't see... as I said, I could not find anything credible about a single election that could have been thrown by impersonation fraud in the last generation. And it's not as though this would be something that would be easier to commit than absentee ballot fraud. It would actually be quite hard because you'd have to have a lot of people doing this on a large enough scale to be able to affect the outcome of an election.
Well, if we're
very
talking about something
do.
That's marginal, though, I'm just wondering because you seem to be somewhat not bothered by what we call razor-thin elections turning on a small number of illegal cast votes, but it can happen, and they're plausible, and they should be of concern, of deep concern, I would think.
Well, I do think that there is a concern about making sure that only eligible voters are able to cast a ballot. The question is, at what cost? So if you said to me, what is the one step you would take to eliminate most of the fraud in our elections, I would say it's very simple. No more absentee ballots. No more absentee ballots except for people who have a real need. They are elderly, they're disabled, or they're overseas in the military.
Yeah, but there's some states that are sending out absentee ballots automatically now.
I mean, right. So I'm saying that if we were serious about combating voter fraud, there's no question this would be at the top of the list because this is where it's a very small problem, but when it happens, it almost always happens. Or it happens more often with absentee ballots than with anything else. Yet we don't do that. Why not? Because we weigh the costs and the benefits. You know, almost half of Californians are going to cast ballots with absentee ballots. We find it very convenient. We say, look, the way we're going to try and deal with this problem is other ways. We're going to do investigations. We're going to use prosecutors to make sure that we can ferret out this kind of fraud, and people are prosecuted for this kind of fraud. So the question is about cost and benefits. When it comes to voter ID on the state level, the amount of fraud we're talking about is infinitesimal, and the burden is at least an inconvenience, and for some people, more than an inconvenience. So and when you're weighing these things, doing the costs and benefits, it seems like you're using the wrong tool to deal with what is a relatively small problem.
Well, I'm looking at some comments on our webpage, and by the way, you can make them at kqed.org/forum and just click on this segment. And Frank says, isn't the requirement for a government-issued ID to vote equivalent to the poll tax, which is something that Attorney General Holder has gone on record as saying, which was declared unconstitutional long ago. The government-issued ID is not free and not easily available for many people.
Well, in fact, these voter IDs are free. All the states that have passed them have made them free. What's not free is the documentation that you would need behind it, like a birth certificate. So it might cost you $20 or something to get that certificate. Let me tell you what my proposal is, how I'd like to fix this. Besides having a national election administration, I'd like to have the government do universal voter registration, register every voter. As soon as you graduate high school or drop out of high school, you're registered. When you turn in that change of address form, you're registered. And then have the government maintain these roles, get all of these private parties out of the business of voter registration, and then have the government provide a national voter ID card, which everyone would get, and the voter would use a thumbprint if the voter wanted to. Optional thumbprint to verify ID, because if you forget your ID when you go to the polling place, you're not going to forget your thumb, so you can use your thumb. This is an idea, this idea of universal voter registration with national voter ID. It's an idea that's united Democrats and Republicans, but it's united them against the proposal. Republicans don't like the idea of universal voter registration. They want it to be more difficult for people to vote. They want people to have to make an extra effort to vote because they think that you should have to. It should be harder to vote because then only the most interested people, those who care the most, will be able to vote. Democrats don't like the voter ID aspect of it. They think it's going to cause more of a hassle and make it hard to get some people to vote. It also gets caught up in immigration issues and privacy issues. But I think really that's the way we need to go. Centralization, uniformity, nonpartisanship.
All right. I've got a listener here, Dan, who says, I find it hard to take your guest arguing that voter ID laws do not disenfranchise citizens seriously. He speaks as though everyone has all the time in the world to go stand in long lines, take time off to work, and even to vote whenever they like. We are talking about disenfranchising the poorest of us, those who tend to be unable to take time off for loss of wages. Democrats have produced plenty of citizens describing hours of time wasted trying to secure IDs. Even Jim Cramer's father was to be disenfranchised due to his inability to secure proper ID. The state then mysteriously got him his ID as soon as his famous son tweeted this injustice to the world. Voting is already a more difficult and onerous task than it needs to be, and any effort to make it harder without the backing of proof of voter fraud is criminal. These new era poll taxes and literacy tests are abhorrent to democracy. Advocating for them is shameful. Well, I don't know that you've actually gone on record here as saying that you don't take disenfranchisement seriously, but you do see it as somewhat marginal in terms of voter suppression.
Well, a lot of the stories of people having trouble getting IDs now are coming out of Pennsylvania, and I absolutely think the judge was right, and I thought he was wrong earlier when he was right yesterday in blocking the law, and he was wrong in not blocking it earlier because we are hearing stories of people going back to the Department of Transportation there in Pennsylvania, going back multiple times, waiting for hours. They just don't have their act together. But if you look generally at if you look at Indiana, you look at Georgia, how they've rolled it out. In Georgia, they made tremendous efforts to get IDs to people in rural areas. It depends on how you do it. And I think it certainly can be a burden on people. And I oppose state voter ID laws because I do think that states don't do a good job generally in administering these kinds of things very quickly, and they don't prevent a lot of fraud. But a national ID card would solve a lot of problems. It would solve the registration problem that I mentioned. We do have a lot of fraudulent registration. It would also solve another kind of fraud, which does happen occasionally, which is double voting across state lines. So sometimes you have someone who has a winter home in Florida and a summer home in New York or Boston, and they vote in both places. That's something that a state ID law would have a hard time catching, but that a national ID, where each person would be registered nationally, you'd be able to catch that. And I want the government not only to provide the ID for free, but also to pay for whatever documentation is necessary in order to verify someone's identity.
Let me get some more callers on. Daniel, join us. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. You haven't yet talked about what I consider the largest form of disenfranchisement and the largest form of fraud. In precincts, large black populations, which vote overwhelmingly Democratic, and Republican officials, there have been numerous cases, particularly in Ohio, of polling places opening late, closing early, broken machines, inadequate number of machines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that people are disenfranchised by not being able to get to the prospect of voting or having to stay in the line for hours and hours, which, you know, for working people is impossible.
Daniel, I think you bring up some good points. I was also going to just add to that. There have been instances where, unfortunately, particularly one political party has disseminated information in certain areas known to be voting for the other party, and I'm talking, of course, about ethnic communities that tend to vote for Democrats, saying the voting polling place has changed. We have a different address now where you should go to. I mean, are these not in the category of disenfranchisement as you see things, Rick?
Well, when it comes to the false information, we do see some of these dirty tricks involving elections. In my book, I go through and I talk about how most of these dirty tricks turn out to not really work very well. One of the examples I give is how a group called Latinos for Reform ran ads in the Sharon Engel, Harry Reid, Nevada Senate race that said, no votes, don't vote. The Democrats have not done enough on immigration reform. Turns out the group behind it, Latinos for Reform, the guy running it was someone who opposed immigration reform. And also it was funded by the largest funder to Latinos for Reform was an anti-abortion activist in Huntington Beach who seemed to have no Latino ties whatsoever. But Democrats turned that around, took that ad, and used it as a way of getting the vote out. And this is something I meant to mention earlier. A lot of this fight over voter fraud and voter suppression is about trying to get the base excited and about fundraising. So Republicans will talk about this voter fraud and Democrats trying to steal the election. There was a great memo that got released as part of the U.S. attorney scandal back during the Bush days when a number of U.S. attorneys were mysteriously fired, where a Republican Party activist in New Mexico sent an email to the U.S. attorney saying, please indict this Acorn woman before the election. It's really going to help Heather Wilson get elected to Congress. It's a great wedge issue. I also talk about Donna Brazile trying to fundraise for the Democratic Party by pointing to what she claimed was massive voter suppression. So I think there's a lot of this gets hyped up by partisans to try and get the vote out, get people excited. They're trying to steal your vote. They're trying to suppress your vote. And some of the stories are exaggerated. Now, in terms of the caller's question about Ohio, in 2008 – in 2004, we did see long lines in urban areas. In 2008, when they rolled out early voting, things went much better. One of the things that concerns me about Ohio rolling back early voting, which the Republican Party, legislature did in between the last two elections, is that we may see those long lines occur again on Election Day. And we're going to have to see how well they run the election. But I do want to emphasize something I talk about in my book. It's a computer science concept called Hanlon's Razor.
Huh.
And it says, It says, don't attribute to malice that which can be explained by incompetence. So if you go back to the Waukesha County clerk who forgot the ballots in the entire
city. Is it incompetence or stupidity?
But what it's not is nefarious. And there was actually an investigation. You know, here was this partisan election official who used to work for the guy in the legislature who was running for state Supreme Court. Looks like a conflict of interest. It is a conflict of interest. But the nonpartisan Government Accountability Board in Wisconsin found no foul play. And lots of times we're very quick to attribute bad motives to the other side, whoever the other side is, and not to accept the fact that they just don't know what they're doing. There's a lot of incompetence throughout the system, whether it's we're talking about local election officials or those who try to commit voter suppression take steps to make it harder for people to vote.
I should mention that we're getting a lot of response from listeners who, well, frankly, are taking you on, feeling that Republican lawmakers are trying to affect perceived Democratic voters. Hard to draw any conclusion other than the fact that this is having some serious impact, blocking voters and suppressing voters. But if your thesis is right, that some of this has really been hyperbolic and exaggerated and overblown and so forth, what about your concern about all these election lawsuits? I mean, if there isn't all that much fraud or suppression, shouldn't we be concerned about these election law tactics?
Well, let me back up for a second. I want to be clear that I do think that Republican legislatures are supporting measures like voter ID, early voting cutbacks, purges of non-citizen votings in order to gain a partisan advantage. I don't think there's any question that these are not motivated by good election reform proposals, but they're done for partisan advantage. What I question is how much effect they're actually going to have. So it's a difference between concern about the intent and concern about the effect. And so the question is, how much impact are they going to have on the election? Is the election going to turn on the fact that there's now a voter ID law in place in some of these states? And I think in terms of the presidential election, I have not seen any evidence suggesting that that's the case.
So now, you have an interesting scenario in the beginning of your book. I mean, and you do talk about the possibility of meltdown. You're not necessarily anticipating that in this presidential election, though.
Well, the thing is, we don't know which presidential election is going to have a meltdown. It's going to be so close. Remember, it have to be for the presidential election to be affected, it would have to be close in a state whose votes are crucial for the Electoral College outcome. That's pretty tough to happen in any one election. But in almost, or maybe I'll say every election since 2000, there's been at least one very close race that's gone into overtime. The Coleman-Franken race, which I mentioned earlier, took 9 months to resolve. The one of my colleagues called it the Lake Wobegon recount because it was it was above average how methodical they were. I would call it the Lake Wobegon recount because it went on way too long. You know, it's just I couldn't take it anymore, which is, well, maybe a commentary about that television show. But it is there would not be the luxury of time that we had in Minnesota to resolve a presidential election. If it came down to a state whose electoral college votes matter, thanks to the rise of social media, I think we could easily see the kind of boiling over from social media into social protests in the streets. I really am concerned that the next meltdown could lead to social unrest in this country. And that's where I end my book.
Yeah, with the possibility of it amplifying conflicts because of social media, in other words. Yeah.
Yes, there have been studies by computer scientists and others that show that people have become less politically tolerant thanks to their discussions, especially on Twitter, where 140 characters is not the best medium for reasoned exchange. And, you look at the comments when I speak on these shows and you read what people say on the left and say on the right, and it's like they're living in two different universes. There's no agreement on the basic facts. There's no agreement on the operational principles. And it's very troubling.
Christopher, join us. You're on. Welcome, Christopher.
Good morning. Yeah, you definitely find a lot of talking over each other's comments. But I was wanting you guys to comment on Greg Tallis' new book, Billionaires and Bandits, and chicanery that a lot of these Republican operatives, Crossroads, GPS with Karl Rove, and they've had a long history of this since Ohio and then Florida in 2000. And so, yeah, what's your guys' comments on what Greg Tallis is bringing out there in his new book?
Do you know Greg Tallis' work on this, Rick Hessen?
I'm afraid I don't.
Yeah.
I don't.
I know he chronicled a lot of fraud techniques, but I've not read the book, so I'm afraid we can't give you that information. Well, let's go to Adrienne as our next caller. Good morning, Adrienne.
Good morning, Michael and Arthur. I have experience with elections in South America, Chile and Venezuela, where what the author is saying has been there for ages. Basically, the national ID is used as an ID to vote. Everyone has a right to vote. The ID is free. I am not proposing a national ID for the U.S., but the voted ID, I think, seems to be a good idea. It's all run by the government, nonpartisan professionals per life working the electoral offices. And election day is a Sunday. It's a holiday. Nobody works. So everyone is encouraged to vote, and the workers cannot be forced to work that day. It's illegal to work. So it's like President's Day or Election Day. It's a major part of our societies, and we have a bigger percentage of voters than we have in the United States, and it's very encouraged, and it's centralized, and it's all the same rules for the whole country, for all the different provinces or states. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Appreciate it. Here's a listener, Marcia, who writes, can you please ask your guest about the behind-the-scenes voter fraud manipulating computers? I would also be interested in the story about former Bain employees operating a business which makes vote-counting machines. And during the Bush era, there were many stories about the vote-counting machines. that had strong ties to Bush. That was the Diebold, I think. So what about computers in all this, Rick Hess?
Well, I do have a chapter in the book that talks about election technology. One of the things I say is that we can't do internet voting, and I have a kind of an amusing story about how the D.C. Board of Elections tried to do an experiment with internet voting, and they invited people to hack in. And the University of Michigan Computer Science Department was able to hack in. They were in there for 4 days. They were unnoticed. They fended off hackers from China and Iran, and then eventually caused the University of Michigan fight song, Hail to the Victors, to play through the Board of Elections machinery to get people's attention. So that that makes me very concerned about internet voting. I do think there's some paranoia, especially on the left, about these voting machines. There are some people who believe that the vote counting technology is subtly has codes in it to give extra votes to Republicans. The best remedy for this is simple, and it's low tech. We should only be voting with ballots that are where there's a paper record which can be audited, and that's really the best practice to avoid any of these kinds of problems.
We're coming to the end of the hour. I just want to read a quick email from Anthony, who says, according to California Watch in Riverside County this year, thousands of Democrats were unwittingly re-registered as Republicans. I'm going to have to look into that because it's something I'm not familiar with. But, Anthony, thank you for sending that. And thank all of you for the emails. I'm sorry I couldn't get to just a shred of them, really. And likewise with Facebook comments. But I want to thank Rick Hasson for being with us. Again, his book is The Voting Wars from Florida 2000 to the Next Election Meltdown. And Kim Alexander, who was with us earlier, president and founder of the California Voter Foundation. Next hour, Sherman Alexie will join us in studio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.